money, honorable member, deputy minister, DG, once more, you all welcome. Deputy Minister, the team, honorable members, the NAFTA team, the members of the public, our friends who are looking here with us, welcome. So we're going to have quite a long day. So let's start with take our problems from the committee secretary.
Thank you, Chair. The following apologies. To Ama, he indicated that we will be unable to attend the meeting due to urgent party matters that we need to attend to. Mr. Tuama, and then the minister is also unable to attend as he is currently abroad. And then Ms. Farku and Ms. Lowe, he hitting that they are late, but they will be joining us. And then the deputy minister has indicated that she wants to stay for the duration of the meeting as well. Most of the apologies, Chair.
We don't have a policy here, so you won't be allowed to leave the meeting unless you submit your apology now.
Chair, thank you very much. We have the minister's plus meeting just next door, and there's some presentations in the room that we have to present the department. So I'm going to speak out from time to time to walking in. So apologies, it's not in disrespect of the committee and minister. Just that you have due responsibility to that. Thank you very much.
So those are apologies. I hope they are all in order. No further apologies. Let's start with the deputy minister, since she's going to be going next door as opposed to the other agency. Deputy minister.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members and guests, and of course the people who will be main focus, the NAFTA team here led by the CEO. Honorable Chairperson, I believe NAFTA has been here a number of times, but today's meeting is really about getting into some of the nitty-gritties and details of how they do their pricing, what are the factors that influence it, what's been the outcomes, and it's obviously something that's very topical because of the challenges we have in terms of energy, and electricity in particular, I guess, would be a focus. So I believe this is really much more an interactive session to clarify and to make sure that members actually do understand what goes into determining issues around the multi-year pricing and all those issues. Before I ask that I hand over to the members, I know this is not the forum, but if you'll allow me to present, I am hoping that as we are doing this, members are also preparing themselves for the debate on the grand agenda, which I want to believe everybody will be supporting, and that these issues are all interlinked because that is the project that's very, very important for us as a country and for the sub-region, and of course the source of the energy, which will be the DRC. Honorable Chairperson, I will be leaving, as you said, because I'm also in the room next door, and there are a number of issues that have a direct impact on the work, and we are expected to make presentations, but we also do not want to be sitting here and find out that decisions have been made on our behalf which we will not be able to actually carry through. So I will sneak out again. It will not be because I don't think this session is important, but I believe it will still be a very good session because the technical people are here, and I think a lot of the work is really going to be around. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Deputy Minister. So you can sneak out, you and the DG, in this year, as soon as you would like to do so. You can have the honorable members behind you if they're going to be supporting the treaty. Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for the opening remarks, Mr. Minister, and we appreciate the fact that we always make every means to attend to committee meetings. Welcome, Honorable Mohamed Shah. The NERSA team led by the CEO is now going to be asking to give us your presentation. I'm told that everybody here in the precinct is talking about your presentation. That's extraordinarily long. Okay. You're welcome. You can go ahead. I hope honorable members, there's no one who wants to read anything at this stage, so let's ask you. I hope you want to explain the length of your presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, the Deputy Honorable Member. I get the opportunity to come talk about the work that we do as NERSA and with the clear guidance we got from the committee about some of the detailed aspects that the committee would have wanted us to focus on. With that in mind, we basically, you know, we prepared a very comprehensive pair of slides, but it doesn't mean that we're going to talk to each and every one of the 199 slides. The committee secretary counted them yesterday and told me that they are 199. Just like only the habit is quite contagious. But what we'll do is, as indicated, the slides are here. Members will be able to ask questions from any part of it, but in terms of presentation, we'll skip some of the slides and we'll move quite quickly through some of them. Before I start the presentation, can I introduce the team that's here today with me? There's Dr. Rod Crompton, to my immediate left, who's the full-time regulator member responsible for petroleum pipeline. Next to him, Ms. Nomfundo Mathetsi, full-time regulator member responsible for pipeline. Next to her, it's Ms. Mbulelo Mathebo, the executive manager for electricity regulation. Here we did communicate with your office, the full-time regulator member responsible for electricity results of the country, and due to prior commitments, and he couldn't reschedule. So we've got the executive manager for electricity regulation. Next to him is Mr. Charles Durrett, regulatory specialist, working in electricity. Then we've got Esther Kalun, Dr. Fenisher, and VFA, senior manager, planning and monitoring. Next to her is Mr. Brian Sitoso. Brian Sitoso is head of department, electricity pricing and tariff. So his team does the actual crunching of the numbers. We then next to Brian have Ms. Theodore Koza, who is advisor to the social regulator member for GAS. Right at the back of the room is Mr. Charles Schedeler, HOD for communication with NERSA. Chairperson, I'm going to start with the presentation and just highlight the manner in which we're going to do it. We're going to do the presentation in four parts. I will start with the intro and present up to the regulatory independence and process, section F. Mathebo will then take over G and do the electricity industry regulation. Dr. Crompton will then do petroleum pipelines industry regulation, and Ms. Mathebo will do the presentation outline. come back to conclude just to do our planning and co-development work. And that's how we will set the presentation. As I promised, we're not going to go through everything. As part of what we circulated, I don't know if this has been circulated yet, we have brought the copy of the RCA NYPDP's decision, and that should be circulated to members as well, for them to be able to just see what went behind that decision. In terms of the introduction, I think now run on by the committee, but I'm going to skip that. Our vision and our mission, I'll just emphasize our vision, because when we focus on the last part of the presentation, it talks to how we plan to be recognized as a world-class leader in energy regulation. Followed by our values, section 3 deals with our mandate. And our mandate, again, we just always try to make sure that we contextualize when we speak, so that is the complete parameters of the laws that regulate us, starting with the primary acts, which are the industry acts and the establishment legislation, the funding acts, which are the labor acts, the facilitating ones, CFMA, promotion of other information, promotion of administrative justice, foundational, the constitution of the country, as well as all other laws. And we list this because we always say we do what we do in accordance with government law, regulations, as well as established government policy. Our mandate, as contained in the various acts, is as follows: the issue of licenses and certain settlement conditions, the setting and or approval of prices and tariffs, and we say that because the different acts use different ways, so if we try and put it all together, in some instances we set prices, in some instances we approve, and you will hear a variety of that when the colleagues present. We have responsibility of monitoring and enforcing compliance with license conditions. We've got the mandate for dispute resolution, gathering foreign and dissemination of industry information, setting of rules, guidelines and codes for the regulation of the three industries, the determination of conditions of supply, as well as applicable standards, and the registration of import and production activities, but not everything that we license, and for instance, we just register the facilities. So, Chair, if I then focus on the National Energy Regulator Act with the intention of moving really for the regulation in terms and dealing with the issues of public participation that the committee is requested that we look at, we thought that we will make a term in the National Energy Regulator Act, which is the act that establishes the National Energy Regulator, repeals relevant technical provisions in the underlying legislation, so that the National Energy Regulator is the only entity that will administer all the acts. It came into operation in September 2005. Institutionally, how the regulator is arranged, we have 9 regulator members, 4 of which are full-time and hold office for a period of 5 years. Current cohort was appointed in April 2011. And there are 5 part-time regulator members who hold office for a period of 4 years, but doesn't coincide with the period of the FTRM to ensure continuity. Now, I have indicated that I have the full-time regulator member sitting to my left. And last time when we presented the annual report, we have seen I brought the chairperson and the chair of the audit committee who come from the part-time component of the board. I think Chair Pascal put the rest of that slide. And in terms of how we arrange our work, we have established various committees and subcommittees as the energy regulator, where the committees deal with regulation work, they're called subcommittees. And we have one for electricity, another one for fast gas, and another one for petroleum pipelines. And meetings are generally open to public, except where confidential matters are considered. I'll come back to that point when I deal with the public participation process. Then we've got the cross-cutting committees as well, cross-cutting transversal, the regulator executive committee, which is essentially the 4 full-time regulator members sitting together, dealing with issues that cut across the three industries. Then we've got governance committees that are not open to the public, so it's the Human Resource and Remuneration Committee, Standing Committee, as well as the Audit and Risk Committee. Human Resource Committee's mandate has just been extended to include the ethics in terms of the King Code Day. Organizational structure, again, that's for contracts, so we've got 6 divisions with a number of departments,
each division is headed by the regulatory manager, so Mr. Matello would be one of those who would head the regulatory division. We've got five specialized support units that are headed by a senior manager, and those report to the CEO, and Esther Felion would be one of those. The regulatory executive manager, so the executive manager is responsible for electricity, for pipelines, and for petroleum pipelines. They report to the CEO, but they have a dotted line to the full-time regulator members, and they spend 80% of their time on regulatory issues. The staff establishment that are approved is 177, and the diagram possibly took months to follow, but it's never been put it here for completeness. And now we have focus on the regulatory independence and regulatory process. We have again restated our regulatory principles. When we did the annual report, we have went through and just showed the list of the principles, what we've tried to get to show what each of those principles they stand for in accordance with our document. So we've got the regulatory principle relating to transparency, which requires us to explain all the decisions that we take and the processes to regulate an entity and other interested parties, implying that the data and information that the decision is based on is readily available, and the reason underlying that decision is readily explainable. We have a value principle of neutrality, essentially where we undertake to be neutral to all market players without favoring one or other group. Regulatory principle of consistency and predictability, who are going to be promoting economic development in the country, consistency and predictability is very important. In relation to NERPA, it means that our decision must be consistent and should have a reasonable degree of predictability based on previous rulings in similar cases. Independence differs from transparency, and the regulator must be independent from the regulated company, from political influence, as well as customer groups. Accountability, the energy regulator is accountable for action, and the fact that we are independent does not mean that we should not account. So it is autonomy or independence with accountability. Second but last, value is integrity, and the regulator should exercise honesty, fairness, and sincerity in the management of stakeholder affairs and energy regulatory affairs, so that no stakeholder feels that another one was prepared in unacceptable circumstances over another. Then lastly is the regulatory principle of efficiency, where the energy regulator undertakes to make the best use of resources to further regulate objectives by exercising objectivity and commitment to evidence-based strategies for improvement. So those are our principles, and I went through them because they inform particularly issues around the public participation in our processes. So the next slide should first deal with the issue of independence and where we get that from. We quote the National Energy Regulator Act, Section 9C specifically, talks about the fact that the energy regulator is expected to act independently. And in carrying out our function, we should do this in accordance with regulation principles, the laws of the country, and what we have included there is published government policy. And I know my colleagues are going to show you what is it that we define as published government policy. In their presentations, they do indicate government policy that we use as a basis for some of the criticisms that we have to take. As an organization, we have developed regulation mechanisms, such as policies, procedures, rules, guidelines, as well as systems that make decision-making processes to be open, transparent, credible, consistent, predictable, as well as keeping us accountable for the decisions we take. Now, if I focus specifically on the public participation process, in order to entrench an engender culture of accountability, openness and transparency, NERPA ensures that public participation takes place in all of the processes. And this we also get from the Constitution, as well as the Promotion of Administrative Action Act, that requires that administrative actions must be open, transparent, reasonable, as well as procedurally fair. We enable openness and transparency as NERPA in the following ways. So the first one is public hearing. We develop processes and procedures for public hearings as contemplated in sections 8.5 and 8.10 of the National Energy Regulator Act. There's a mistake in the slide of it's now granted. The ones that we have is 2010, but it's actually 2007. The procedures were adopted in 2007. What we then do is we invite the public through newspaper, webcast, and radio to come and listen to the sessions during the public hearings. It is a requirement of the rules that the parties who are entrusted to make presentations must register with the energy regulator. We try and enforce this one, but we've also demonstrated a high level of flexibility because we think that in the interest of fairness, sometimes a stakeholder would decide late that they would want to make a presentation, and we do not embrace that, and we haven't had too many instances thereof, but we do prefer that people register first. And members of the public are expected to present their facts, the reasons for their arguments, as well as whatever evidence that they have in their possession. Only panel members, which consist of regulator members, are allowed to ask questions during public hearings. And it's probably something we might want to look at the process improvement around, but at the moment the rules say only members of the panel can ask questions. And members of the public are allowed to present in their preferred language. And in instances where certain presenters use certain language, we then have interpretation as we go around the country, focusing on the regional dominant languages, we do that. Perhaps here I should also add that we are, as an organization, looking at the language policy of the organization, and this was something we had started doing before the Department of Arts and Culture came through with that regulation that calls on all government agencies to establish a language unit, a language policy, and start practicing multilingualism of the country. So we are currently consulting on proposed language policy for the organization to nurse before. It's one of those documents that was issued for public consultation. Now, I thought that at this point it would also be useful to focus on what we experienced during the MIPDC process in 2013, where members of civil society raised the following points for NERSA to consider. One of the points was the location of hearings. They issued them out very sharply in the Eastern Cape, and the words used to describe the venue as a bit of a leafy suburb. But it's a point that we will take into heart and make sure that we locate our hearing places that are accessible for everyone physically as well. The timing of hearing, we normally hold our hearings during the day, 9 or 10 o'clock, and there were communities that were saying we are working, will not be released from work to come and make these types of presentations. Consider using the evening as well for your hearing. And then in one hearing in particular, there is the issue of the documentation, the knowledge of the documentation. Anyone of the members of Finland has complication is also this disk, and it's very technical language that contained in the application. We will work with ESCOM around that issue to see if we can get a simplified version going with it and then look at the other languages. And then the last issue that was raised, not too strongly, but it's an issue that was raised, was the format of the dialogue. We run this in the formalistic sense of people giving in written documents, making PowerPoint presentations. And some communities say that that's not how you speak to people, and we know that government uses the invisible approach, which is, you know, sometimes called the town hall approach. People just come and they raise their views, you take their views down, you know, and have a conversation and then take that material into your decision-making processes. It's one of those things that we'll also look at as we look at the continuous improvements within the work that we do as NERSA. The second manner in which we try and promote public participation is what we call notice and comments. We currently, as I indicated, have issued our proposed language policy. So we considered in the organization and said this is a preliminary review. We're going to take that out to the public. We've issued it, we've given people 30 days to comment on it. And then we will take those comments into account and take a final decision on the language policy. But we do that for all the documents that we produce as an organization now, methodologies, a whole lot of documents that we have, even the rules and that we pass. And then we have a notice and comment period as well for decisions. So we've taken a decision, we'll send it out for comments, take comments, and then the final decision will then be published. Lastly, participation in the Energy Regulator Subcommittee meetings. I did indicate that the meetings of the Energy Regulator and the subcommittees are open to members of the public. As indicated, the public is accorded only observer status during these meetings, but they can sit throughout and listen to all the debates that happen in these meetings. In some instances where charity is required, further charity is required, an applicant may be accorded an opportunity to address the committee on a specific issue. The last way we involve the public is to look at to do stakeholder workshops. So this is now the workshop in most that we go into stakeholders. We go in there as a regulator, but it's informal. We present some issues and members of the public ask questions. And we have found that it did a lot of good for the guest decision before we took the maximum price of guest decision. We consulted and discussed with stakeholders. We do it for electricity as well, where we workshop communities and interested parties about what the price of electricity entails, what components make it up, and how people can then participate and support in that process. The last slide on this, the picture is not too great, but at the top left-hand corner there is the panel. This was in Mpumalanga, if I recall, the MIPD3 in Mpumalanga, the session. And there's a committee member who asked about registration and the register, whether or not we keep a register. There's a desk, typically would look like that, which is like a delegate text. In this one picture here at the bottom left, we show somebody doing a presentation. And here we're just showing the audience. This was one that was particularly full. Sometimes we only have one or two people in the room, but this one we had a lot of people in. I can tell you just if I look at that staff number now. With that, Chair, can I call on the public discussion processes and hand over to my colleague who will deal with the electricity industry regulation matters, Mr. Mbula Demetrius.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, and the honourable members of the committee. My presentation on the electricity regulation led in the regulator. And I begin with I will go quickly over the slides that she's gone through so that we don't repeat. And I will be concentrating more on the slides that have got to do with the key functions that we do as a regulator. On the slide, I just have to say that we regulate this industry, mandated by the Electricity Regulation Act 2006. We also have key policies that we use in our regulation, that is the Electricity Pricing Policy of 2008 and the Integrated Resource Plan. We also have a key regulation that we use, that is the Nuclear Capacity Regulation. These will come up in the next slide. The objects of the era, these are the objects of the era, we'll not go through them, but you'll see as we go through the presentation as to how we implement this. This slide. The functions, we always go through the functions of the energy regulator, and I will not repeat those. They apply to our to the regulation. This is the industry structure that we regulate in electricity. It is dominated by ESCO, the vertically integrated incumbent. ESCO generates 95% of the power in Africa, and they also distribute 40% of the electricity to end users. In 2007, there was a cabinet decision that 30% of power will be of new generation capacity, will be from IPPs and 70% will be from ESCO, and that ESCO will be a single buyer. The IPPs will be lent to ESCO under long-term average purchase agreements. With a total of 108 distributors, including ESCO, 134 municipalities, patient site distribution, distributors, and ESCO. And the distributors distribute 3% to end users. I mean, they distribute 3% to end users. This is the kind of structure of the industry in pictures where you can see, there you can see ESCOM, the vertically integrated ESCOM. And also you've got, in generation, you've got some municipalities that have got their own generation. You only have IPPs that have power and they sell to ESCOM, but they do have bilaterals where IPPs sell directly to some of the customers. Basically, in South Africa, we can see now that the customers in South Africa, the mind is such that customers don't have a choice. If you are under Ebolelani, then you have to be supplied power by Ebolelani as a customer. So this is the market structure that we have in South Africa, where you have got a generation and company, transmission monopoly, and a distribution, a fragmented distribution industry. This slide is supposed to show what is happening in South Africa. The red graph there tells you the demand, peak demand in South Africa. This is over a year. The red graph is the demand in 2007, and green one tells you what the demand is currently in 2014. What we want to show here is that the demand in South Africa still has to get to the point where it was in 2007. The maximum demand in 2014 right now is 35 gigawatts. Next up. What is happening in the last, again, this shows you the energy availability factor for Eskom generation. In 2007, it was 85.53. It has gone down now to 75.72. That is, though we have capacity available in the country, our problem is that that capacity isn't available. And the reason why, you can see in the green graph, where you find that the PCLS and UDLS are going up. PCLS is the, it's a planned capacity loss factor. That is when Eskom goes up to do maintenance and take out plants. And the UDLS, the one that you don't want, because those are paid down when the power that is supposed to be generated is not generated, because the generators are either faulty or they are forced with the system. That is the one that is rising at the beach in South Africa, and we are talking to Eskom to try to make sure that that is brought down so that we get our EAF back to the 80% level as in the past. This slide shows the installed capacity in South Africa, where we've got the baseload down there, which is followed by OCGT and the residential service foundation. If you look at that and look at the actual demand in the country, which is this red line here, you find that we are right there right now, and yet the capacity that we have, the potential that we have, is that much. And that's due to the PCLS and the UCLS that I spoke about in the previous graph that are existing. So what we need to do is to make sure that we make sure that the availability of these generators is increased in South Africa. So we've got enough capacity in South Africa, it's just that it's not available due to various factors. Thank you. In the past year, 2 or 3 years, we've been increasing the number of renewable energy IPPs, and up to date, we've got 1,256 megawatts that has been connected to the grid. That is your wind and your solar. It's mostly wind and solar. This graph shows us the contribution of these renewable energies to our energy. Here, this is over a week period. This one over here, I think it's orange. That is the sun. As you can see, the sun peaks during the day, and then it goes down in the evening, and we don't have anything in the evening. Whereas wind, this is wind. Wind is quite random, and wind can assist us in during the peak period, during the evening peak and the morning peak, in that we do have wind during the good period, whereas the sun is just not there. But the solar here that peaks during the day here, midday, like that, okay, that can help us in the summer, because in the summer, you find that our low profile in South Africa is quite flat. And because it's flat, we tend to use a diesel or OCGT, which is the diesel generator, during the day, not through the day. If you can have more of this solar during the day in South Africa, it can help us reduce our dependence on OCGT during the day in summer. The next slide is it shows the history of the price, the price in South Africa. That is the average price. Look at that. It first had NYPD1 from 2006 to 2008. And as you can see, the price of that, the average interest is 5.1, 5.9, and 6.2. We could only implement the first two increases in 2006 and 7 during NYPD1, because in 2008, Eskom came back to us several times asking for more and more increases. We ended up, the interest went up to 6.2% to 27.5%, and the price during that same period, it went up from 17.91 cents a kilowatt hour to 25.24 cents. Per kilowatt hour in 2008. And then in 2009, instead of again going through NYPD2, Eskom suggested that they'd like to spend that year looking at the funding structure to make sure that they got enough funding going forward. So we had an interim period in which they asked for, they were given the 1.3% increase, and that took the price to go to 1.57 cents per kilowatt hour. And in it took the price to 34.14 cents per kilowatt hour. And then 2010 to 2012, we had now what we call MIPD2. And that increases that we allowed it from 25.8%, 25.8%, and 25.9%. But for 20 channels, that's something that you are asking for a decrease in the price. Hence, the increase now was brought down from 25.9%, which was allowed, to 15%. And that took the price down from 65% to 60.6% per kilowatt-hour. Then here, MIPD3 for 2013 to 2013. There we give it from 8% for the 5 years, for each of the 5 years. Right now we have the second year, 2014, where the price is 8% and the price is 24.75 cents per kilowatt hour. But since then we have just received MIPD2 RCA, which is the shortfall that some experience during the MIP2 period. That led us to an increase now of 12.69% because that's the balance that we calculated for approved for ESCOM was 7.8 billion rand. So if you add 7.8 billion rand to what we already approved for them in terms of the alarm revenue, so that will hit the price next year to 12.69% instead of the 8% that we allowed. And the average price is going to be 79.72 per kilowatt hour. So that means you can say about 2016 and 2017 at this point in time, because we do know that there is an RCA that is accumulating somewhere in South Africa. We don't know yet what it is, but we do believe that it will change that 8% and 8% that we have approved for 2016 and 2017. Hence, you see those down there. Something that we cannot tell at this point in time, but we do know that ESCOM can come to us any time to say that the RCA balance is such that we have to increase that. Thank you. And that's why you need to know the regulators mainly, as you know. And as we said, we have a mandate from the Electricity Regulation Act. We have to regulate prices that the licenses are charged. And Section 51, the very, very, very important one, that's what where our MIPD is based on, in that we say that the regulator must enable an efficient licensee to recover the full cost of its license activities, including a reasonable margin of return. That one is very important. We're talking about going forward. And Section 15.1 C and D says that they must avoid undue discrimination between customer categories. And that, again, very important, may permit the cross subsidy of tariffs to certain customer classes. So subsidization, cross subsidization, is something that is allowed in the Act, as we will see later on. This also comply with the principles of the electricity policy document. In Section 4A, it says we issue rules designed to implement the national government's electricity policy framework and integrated resource plan in the Act. This is how we build up to the revenue of ESCOM. All our licensees should, the distributor, should conduct a cost of service study. From the cost of service study, they should do a tariff line, which should give the resulting tariff structure for different customer categories. And all of that, from those structures, they must make sure that the allowed revenue that allowed the utility or ESCOM should be recovered from the different customers according to their customer categories. So this is how we get to recover that allowed revenue for ESCOM. It starts with the utilities making sure that they design the tariff categories and make sure that those customers can be able to give the necessary revenue. ESCOM revenue determination, this is the big one that we do. In the next few slides, we're going to be talking about that. This is based on a multi-year price determination. We opted for the multi-year price determination because we wanted to give certainty to customers and users and make sure that there's predictability. As we said before, it started in 2005 to 2008 for a three-year period. The second one was in 1st of April 2010 to 2013. Again, that was over a three-year period. And there was an interim period to reach in 2009, as I said before. And then recently, the MIPD has been increased to 5 years, that is control period. This was a request from ECOP for us to increase that. This is very good if you want to make sure that it is stability. But that very much depends on the integrity of the forecast that ESCOM makes. The MOPD2 was reviewed in the third year. This has gone through in that when I was into the plan. So these have been going through. Let's move on. With MOPD mechanism, some intensive on incentives on governments of the time. The mechanism contains a high-risk management device that deals with the differences between forecast and actual performance. If we're going to do the MIPD, the cost and everything that is available to us are focused by the assessment. So as the years go by, you find that the actuals actually are different from what they estimated. Hence, we have developed what you call a regulatory cleaner account. That is where all the variances are deposited over the years, so to make sure that at the end of the period, we do a reconciliation depending on the level of that balance. This is very small, but for those who've got the here, these are the components of MYPD array. We've got the regulatory return. As I said, section 15.1A says that we must make sure that the utility gets their costs covered and also they get a return on their assets. So these are the components of MYPD. The first one is the regulatory return. This is the return on the assets of the utility, in this case ESCOM. The return is based on the WACC. We also add to that fuel cost. These are the costs we're talking about. And we also add to that independent power producers. As I said, independent power producers sell to ESCOM. So we've got to make sure that in their revenues that are allowed, you'll have enough money to pay for IPPs. And we also have to add asset depreciation. And also IDM, that is Integrated Demand Management. And we also add operating costs, and also government taxes on levies. And we can either add or minus the RCA balance. And in the case that we have RCA 2, it will have to add that because it's going to be under recovered. All of this will equal your allowed revenue for ESCOM. So these are the components of the MIPD that we have to look through. And when it comes to the costs themselves, that's where we as a regulator have to apply our mind to check as to whether all those costs have been efficiently incurred. Now it comes to what we call the CASA, that is the retail tariff. Once we determine the increase for ESCOM, we now have to go back to a slide where I showed you everything that happened. We have to show how ESCOM now will recoup those revenues for the different types of customers. That's what ESCOM is all about. The other price is compared to previous years, average price to Iraq, and the average price increase for the percentage. And then the average price must be recovered from US customer charter to the best rate. And these are based on the cost of supply, that is, this repeats in words what I said in the slide that shows that the different customer categories now must contribute to the allowed revenues for ESCOM to get to the allowed revenue. Now we get to the RCA balance, which is in the current news and so on for today. The RCA account is an account, as I said, in which we put all the potential adjustments for ESCOM's allowed revenue. And what we do is we put in variances from forecast coal prices, variances from forecast of planned capital expenditure, variances from forecast sales volume. Because as I said, the MIPD, when it comes to us as an application, is all based on estimates. So this is what we do after we've got through the years. When we compare the actual to what actually happened, we take those variances and put them into the account. This account is created at the beginning of the year, and we monitor it continuously. Because ESCOM gives us, or supposed to give us, quarterly reports, which we use to make sure that we monitor the actuals. The RCA balance is then measured as a percentage of the total allowed revenue. Now the rules for the RC power, in where we say that if it's less than equal to 2%, then we just move on to the following year. We don't do anything. But now if RC balance is between 2% and 10%, then the amount is allowed for a drawdown required in certain adjustment for the financial year. This is the majority that happened in this year. This balance now was in 10%. So what we did, we just added it on and said that in the following year, that is 2015-16, the RCE balance will be implemented. That's what has taken us to, or what's going to take us to 12% in the next year, instead of the 8% of allowed. If the balance is more than 10%, then we actually have the reopener, where there will be a full stakeholder consultation, so that everybody can have a say as to what to go forward. At the end of the MIPDQ period, the balance in the RC account will be liquidated and taken into account will determine the revenue requirement for the next MIP period. That is going to be the opening balance for the next MIPD period. MIPDQ period accounts, if some apply for revenue for short-term heating period at the end of the MIPDQ period, this is now to show how we got to the 7.8 billion that we approved. The allocation of balance using the RC rules containing the MIPD methodology by us, and the balance was approved in favor of ESCOM. But again, the difference between that 7.8 billion and that 18 billion that they applied for is again because we as a regulator, we have to take everything, that is the expenses that will be presented to us, we've got to apply a test of proof then, and then when you did that, we brought that 18 billion down to 7.8 billion. Bulk of this balance was from the open cycle testing events, that is the diesel generators that are very expensive, and a shortfall in revenues. This revenue shortfall, we had a problem sometimes because on the one hand, we are saying that ESCOM should make sure that everybody must save on electricity, and ESCOM has an IDM project where they actually pay or the customer pay for people to reduce their usage of electricity. But then again, when that happens, you find that now, it will come in again and then the shortfall is now in my revenue, so the price must go up again. So it doesn't mean that I think we are about to look at again as to why it is that the customers pay for IDM, and if IDM is successful, again, they have to pay for that. So there, I think, there's something that we should get. The MYPD Active Implementation Plan was developed and approved by the energy regulator, and that balance of 7.8, as I said, will lead to an increase of 12.7% next year instead of the 8% that was approved. Now coming to the municipality insurance, here I must say that the way we regulate the municipality is a little bit different from the way we regulate ESCOM. As I said, with ESCOM, with MIPD, we need to know their actual cost, we need to know their assets, and we have to look out a return that is commensurate with the risk. But when it comes to the municipalities, that's not what we use. And we use a different methodology, which is called benchmarking. We still have to move to something like an ROA so that we know exactly how they manage their expenses. But as I said, this got a correct here in this slide, 187 licensed distributed manufacturers. 124 municipalities and 13 private distributors, which gives us 188 distributors. We, as I said, developed the municipal guidelines in systems and tariff manufacturing level based largely on the ESCOM price. So everything is based on the ESCOM price. We have to determine first the ESCOM interest and then from them to the ERSA, and from the ERSA we come to this one for the municipalities. The guidelines of municipalities in preparing their budget in this time, when they apply to or their interest in the following year, they use these guidelines, which is and the benefits. The tariff benchmark, the tariff range, that is the benchmark will tell you that maybe for a customer of the category, the range should be 50 cents to 54 cents. By so doing, we are trying to harmonize the tariffs in the country because they are very different from province to province, from municipality to municipality. So this benchmark actually helps us to try to harmonize the tariffs of the country. That is different. Approved guidelines, together with the tariff benchmarks, are communicated to them, the municipalities, ahead of time so that they can prepare for the following year. The licenses are then invited to submit their proposed clerical charges, that is the application. And we as a regulator have to look at them, and based on what we see there, and our, based on our prudency test, we approve whatever we feel has to be approved. And according to the MFMA of 2003, the municipalities in the maintaining of charity interests is on the 1st of July every year. Now, we say that knowing that ESCO financial year is from April to March, and from April to June, the municipalities, ESCO cannot increase to the municipalities until the 1st of July. But that 1st of July is, as I say, in the MFMA, and it cannot be changed right now. So what this requires, it requires that by the 15th of March, we as nurses should have approved all the municipal tariff applications that we have in front of us. Because if we don't do that, then the municipalities will not be able to implement the following 1st of July. In the previous years, there's always been a slippage in this that the units will not be applying in time for us to do the determination before the 15th of March, and then we have to go to the Minister of Finance to ask for a confirmation of that. The principle for determining the guideline interest. When determining the price of municipalities, the proposed price increase applicable to municipalities will be based on a study that is done in determining the guideline. What we found in this that in our benchmarking exercise is that approximately 20% of the cost of the municipality is on their purchases from ESCO. And to get to the municipal guideline, according to the formula down there, the municipal guideline increase is based on the case, these are the bulk purchases by the municipality, multiplied by the increase, bulk purchase in the interest to the municipality from ESCO. If ESCO's interest to the municipality is like, let's say, 8%, then we multiply that 20% by the 8%. And what we get is a summation or weighted average of all the costs. That is, this one is salary, this one is repairs and maintenance, and that one is the other cost. And this one is the capital expenditure, right? And these are the indices that we use. So that takes us to the average increase for the municipality. That is how we get to the municipal increase from the ESCO increase to meet those assumptions. When reviewing applications by municipalities, the financial guidance of municipalities is addressed, as I said, and the performance of municipalities is measured through the financial and technical benchmarks. The technical benchmarks are things like the losses of the municipalities. We, in our benchmark, for instance, the 10% is the benchmark, and even if it's like 20%, it's less than 20%, then in giving them an increase, we take that into consideration. So if they wanted to say 20% increase, we make sure that they get less than that. So because we say to them, had you been efficient enough, you would be able to do that. The percentage applied by municipalities is also compared to guidelines that are issued by the on an annual basis. NERSA may also approve tariffs that are above the guideline interest, but for us to do that, the municipality must come to us and present to us in the public hearing, and we look at what they are putting forward as an innovation. And some of them will come to us and say that they have capital expenditure and the purchase amendment that they have to do. In which case the insurance data will make sure that he gets the increases that he made. Tariff guideline structures. In designing tariffs, certain supposition that tariffs are aligned to the principles of the electricity pricing policy. They should be equitable and fair. The tariff increases should be predictable and stable. And the tariff level of actions should accommodate the social programs. These are the principles that we follow when we're designing those. The basic tariff structures that we have is one, the IBTs, local IBTs, dynamic block tariffs, that were introduced by NERSA in 2010-11. This is a single energy rate that is of course expressed in terms of cents per kilowatt hour. We also have two budget tariffs, where you've got energy rate, cents per kilowatt hour, or energy monthly charges, or rent per month. We also have two-part tariffs, where you've got an energy rate plus a fixed monthly charge and a demand charge, RKV, rent KV charge. That covers the capital of the utility. We also have two part term of your charge and two part term of your charge. They may also be variable of these structures, but this will be based mainly on the municipality profile and at least meet the terms that you mentioned. Now, talking about IBTs, IBTs we think are simple, but we found out that the customers do find them simple, so there's a lot of education that we have to do as necessary. The block tariffs that we have opposed are as follows: from 0 to 50 kilowatts, we call that block 1. From 51 to 350, block 2, block 3 is 600, and over 600 kilowatts per hour per month, that is block 4. So commercial sales, the average consumption that we assume is 200 kilowatts per month. For industrial sales, the average consumption is 43 megawatt hours per month, and also the installation of like 200 kV at least. And the load factor that we assume is 8%. As you can see, when it comes to current, we have to make assumptions, and that's what we do. But we still need these assumptions, having taken into consideration the actual weather of the field. Sometimes the current, especially in commercial industries, some of them are intensive current, and we also have agricultural current to cater for agriculture. Some variations to about structures, which may even be based on the behavior plan structure between the parties are approved. So we do have what you call special pricing differential. It's something that is allowed in the Act. It's some of the things that we even have approved when people come to us as parties that have agreed on them and they presented them to us and we approve those. Those are not something that we're just allowed in the Act. In terms of locality, we approved it on the 24th of February 2010. And the Eskom tariffs, in order to provide cross subsidies for low domestic customers. The customers in Block 1, they pay lower prices mostly, and those in Block 4, they pay a higher price. But the utility, at the end of the day, has to be able to get the required revenue. Meaning that between Block 4 and Block 1, there will be cross subsidies from the higher block to the lower block. IBT tariffs to adjust it optimally. They allow the protection of low-income users and promote energy efficiency. They promote energy efficiency in this that they say, if you use more, you're going to pay more. So people are encouraged to use less so that they pay less. The two objectives that are LDPP, therefore, are complied with by implementing IBT. What is an inclined block structure? An IBT is a tariff structure where customers' consumption is divided into blocks as shown. Each block has a tariff per unit, as I show. For example, a low block rate for the first 100 kilowatts of consumers and a high block rate for the balance of the consumption. So, the more you use, the more you pay, but the less you use, the less you pay. It must be noted that the IBT is only applicable for residential direct customers for now. We have not allowed it for industrial and other customers. This is an example of IBT box. Here you can see that from 0 to 50 kilowatt-hours, the investment will pay 86% to 8 cents per kilowatt. For block 2, you'd want to pay 50, you pay 87 cents per kilowatt hour. Block 3 goes up to block 4. So the more you use, the more you pay. Key design principle, as you said, I've mentioned this before, it's called Esther. Licensing. According to the era, we have to license anyone who is involved in these activities, generation, transmission, distribution, import, export, and trading. Now, each and every license that we grant, we impose license conditions we should comply with. And the other people is that when someone applies to us, it should not take us more than approximately 20 days to process application. And after the license has been issued, we monitor compliance with those conditions that we put. We currently have 334 licenses covering global activities, as I said earlier on. Now, that's the general issue that we asked by the committee later, I mean earlier on. One was about the load sharing and verification on ESCOM from the 20th of April, March 2014. We asked ESCOM to provide us with a detailed report on this matter. And they did submit the report of the in September 2014, and we are still going through that report before we can make our final findings. What you've done, our preliminary findings are as follows. There's a delay in building new capacity, and that we all know, with the people today and others. And the age related deterioration of the generation fleet. That leads to that increase in the unplanned capacity of factor, that is a breakdown. That also leads to Eskom now maintaining more plans, and that takes away from the EAF that is available. And there was a government mandate to keep the lights on Eskom's part. That also led to that because instead of doing maintenance on times when they have to do maintenance, they'd rather hold on and postpone it, so that we can keep the lights on. The past performance I've spoken about, deferred maintenance I've spoken about, and then the coal quality, the issue of the coal quality in our mind, where the coal quality is such that the machines cannot give out the output that is required from the rated output. Eskom is currently preparing a plan for the acceleration of the restoration of capacity and reliability of fleet that is submitted to us. But we've been knocking on Eskom's door, saying that low-hanging fruit for us to increase the availability factor of the bus. The level of BGPH investigation. This investigation is being done in terms of Section 31 of the year, the short law, to what the Act says. What is done so far? Therefore, we request Eskom to provide a national certification for the application, including the benefit of the interruptible load, which they receive for free. Interruptible load means that an industrial customer, for instance, when Eskom finds that they're short of power or the demand is too high, they can ask the customer to cut down, and in some instances, they pay some customer to do that. But in the case of Billiton, they will not be paying Billiton for doing that. So that's an advantage and a benefit to Eskom to have that contract in that respect. Secondly, we gave Eskom Billiton a chance to respond, and Eskom's comment on the response was not received. And I said comment department was given an opportunity to also to comment on the provided input, so to provide input and independent input. The answer to the import were input of the leaves from the Aluminium Federation of South Africa, AFSA, when they had that going through this investigation. Specific input was sought from industry specialists, and right now National Staff has done their own analysis. And at present, we are seeking a legal opinion from the Senior Council on specific issues concerning our mandate and public interest. The other one that was asked was on embedded generation. Embedded generation has the potential, we agree, to be disruptive, to have a disruptive effect on municipal nature revenues. Because this generation, most of it, will be connected at municipal level. Most municipalities are not well positioned to cope from a health point of view, and technical and financial point of view, with this disruptive effect. We are waiting for a consultation paper right now, which should be published sometime in 2015, which will aim to highlight these issues. And we hope that that will result in a regulatory framework for this class of generators. It is also important to extract the benefits of this generation. Those things that might have some destructive effects, but there are benefits that can mitigate the adverse effects. And all customers are involved, whether they install embedded, whether all customers are involved, whether they install embedded generation or not. We really are saying embedded generation might be good, it might be disruptive. There are some municipalities in forums in Kingdom that have come to us this year saying that they'd like to apply for an above guideline interest this year because the sales are going down because of embedded generation. The embedded generation is decreasing their sales. If that can happen to the metro, what would happen to a smaller municipality? So it's something that we as Vasquez now have to talk about. Hence, we are now putting together this current paper. So if we can look at all the pros and cons of embedded generation. And if maybe we'll have a legal framework for embedded generation, because the options of the Act are in the same. There must be an orderly development of this industry. Let's make sure that nothing will be disruptive to the industry. Yes, sir? I think Chair, that was it on electricity. I'm sorry for the long one, but I hope that they will answer the questions that we have. Thank you.
Can we go through the whole presentation and then the session will be taken away?
No, not if that is completed presentation. That's you. So you had no intention of being a I see there's no break here, so we have no intention of being a school.